this is May 16th, 2009, and this is a pastor teleconference on spiritual laws. So welcome to everyone. I wanted to start off with a slight bit of trivia and to bring your attention to the fact, which I find unique and interesting, that of all the pathwork lectures which were numbered, this is lecture 171 is the only lecture that the guide did not give. So in the fine print, if you download the lecture up in the upper right-hand corner, where it normally says the guide gave this lecture on this date, what it says is this was given by one of the guide's helpership training groups, one of the groups that Ava and the guide were training to become helpers. And I don't want to make anything out of it. I just find it curious that this lecture is the only one that was numbered in that sequence and yet was not a guide lecture. Now, on the internet, on the website, I have mounted the final draft of the study materials, and in there you're going to find two other documents also written by training classes. One I use a lot, and that's called PC-10. That's the primary document I use to teach spiritual law from. I normally boil it down to one page, but the original is about 4 or 5 pages, so that is now, it's a 12-page document that I mounted. So I have, it starts off with a one-page version of spiritual principles, and then it goes into about 6 pages of the entire PC-10. And that means pathworkers' contributions. So there is guide material that is numbered in lectures. There is guide material that was random and got transcribed, and that's called additional materials. And they're not all on the web. Then there are Ava's, some pieces that Ava wrote, and those are called EP, and there's numbers to that. And then there's PC, which is pathworkers' contributions. And obviously they were trying to keep this stuff codified and had some order to it. But as you can see, if there's 5 categories, the dates vary a lot. So it's just a matter of finding the materials as you can and reading according to your level of interest. And allowing serendipity and eros to take you where you need to go. So starting with the one page of PC-10 and then the 5 pages of the whole version, then I took lecture 171 and distilled it down to 2 pages, which is what I normally do to give people a brief overview. I always recommend that you read the entire lecture, but some people don't have time, and the 2-page condensation allows them to get the gist of it, so that they can work with the concepts. And then after that, there was a document called AM-22 by the same training class, created in 1978. The original 171, I think, was 1969 was the date. So it is 5 or 6 or 7 pages of another dissertation on spiritual law. So as you can guess, this is not a Ten Commandments kind of thing. There's no dogma in pathwork. There's no catechism. There's no, you must believe this. This is your statement, your creed, that if you want to be a pathworker, you believe this. And there are a lot of different interpretations, and I like that personally, because even the guide says, do not accept this verbatim. Challenge what you are told by me. Do not just accept. Argue with it. Debate it. Work on it. So to simply say the guide said so is submission. And submission is not an act of spiritual growth. Versus surrender, which is acknowledging the wisdom, perhaps, of a spiritual entity, without necessarily understanding at all. So in submission, you simply say, you're in charge. declared, you're right, I'll do what you're told. But in surrender, it may sound the same, but what it is a trust. It's a faith. I do not understand, and yet I am willing to bend my actions in a certain way to conform with how you are presenting things to me. And I will have faith that I will pick this up as I go along, that I will understand perhaps in future. There's a difference between simply submitting to what the guide says and going on faith and working with it even though you have some protest. But again, what the guide says is notice your protest. So I bring this up because I am fascinated by the fact that the guide never actually delivered a lecture keyed onto spiritual law. And the presumption that I do make from that is that perhaps the guide was slightly leery, of people's desire for finality. So in other words, very often if you've read very many lectures, in the question and answer section, somebody says, what is this? What is that? How do you interpret this? And over and over and over, the guide says, there is no one answer. There is no one way. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the intention. You must not take this and put too broad a view on it. Over and over, when asked specifics about individual lives, this is what the guide says. And yet in the lecture, when he's talking about concepts, he's very concrete, very firm, very certain of what is true. But when it comes down to an individual case, he always have to look at your heart. You have to look at the specific situation, and you cannot judge for another person. So for these reasons, perhaps the guide chose not to deliver a specific lecture on spiritual law, once again, because people like life to be finite. So that, I'm trying to give you a bit of an overview of the study of spiritual law, which is interesting, and the fact that that there is no specific list, although the word law is mentioned many, many, many times. But there is an overall principle to spiritual law. And what I'm going to do next is I'm going to go into the difference between spiritual law and human law. I'm being a little bit awkward here because it occurs to me that I need to talk about a topic that I am slightly uncomfortable talking about. I'll explain that. I love the lectures on creation, which basically are lectures 17 to 22. I love to understand, as much as a human mind can, the cosmology of the universe. It gives me a sense of boundary. It gives me a sense of what we're all here for. And included with that batch of lectures are, although the lectures are titled God, Salvation, Jesus Christ, the Fall, they're intermixed. You really need to read all five lectures to get the picture. And in the lecture on Jesus Christ, the reason I am uncomfortable is any discussion of Jesus Christ does create a twinge in human beings about their religious upbringing and their religious beliefs. I find Pathwork to be extraordinarily generous. It does not ask, it does not demand, it does not suggest what your religion or what your religious beliefs should be. However, as I said before, the guide is very firm about what he says, this is how it is. I'm sorry if it offends. I am sorry you don't like it, and this is how it is. So when the guide talks about Christ, he doesn't apologize. He simply says, there is truth here. And in the lecture on Christ, there is a reference that I think needs to be stated here, and that is both in the lecture on Jesus Christ and on God. And that is that when God created spiritual law, whether it was a deliberate second act, separate act, or whether it was just part and parcel of his creation, and it can be talked about separately, but it cannot be separated from his creation. In the discussion of God and the creation, the guide says that God must obey spiritual law. There is no choice here. And yet there is a choice. God could break spiritual law. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but what I got out of this was, who would God be if he could make exceptions to his own laws? So what I get from this is that even God accepts that the power to break the law does not make it right, and that to be God, one must not do such things, even if that power did exist. Now, in the lecture on Jesus Christ and the fall, the guide talks about Lucifer, talks about the fall of the angels, and a lot of things that have been picked up by various religions, perhaps because it is true, and we all get bits and pieces, and we weave our own cultural stories in, and wind up, in the end, becoming quite disparate about these stories. And yet the source may be intuition about a central spiritual truth, which also may not be able to be expressed in words the way we would like it to be. So in other words, the creation and God and the fall of the angels is not like the history of a specific battle on the planet Earth. It may not be describable in terms that we can understand. So, that being said, the lecture on Christ says and the fall says that Lucifer was not bound by spiritual law, and at some point God challenged Lucifer, and Lucifer said, I will agree to be bound by spiritual law if. And I'm not going to fill that in. I invite you to read the lectures. And because the if was accomplished, even Lucifer lives by spiritual law. Now, I'm going a bit beyond the lectures here. This is my philosophy, so simply hear it, throw it away if it doesn't work. There is a quality within mankind that feels that the devil can cheat, that feels that evil can be thrust upon you without your permission, that you can be seduced, that you can be forced to do things truly against your will. Pathwork says that is not true. However, in the creation lectures, there is a hint given that there may have been a time period where that was true. And by that I mean that if Lucifer was not obeying spiritual law and, in effect, cheating, so that cause and effect, law of responsibility, if none of those worked, and he could do whatever he pleased, during some phase of mankind's existence. And then at some point, Lucifer agreed to abide by spiritual law and could no longer cheat, but had to convince people to become evil or dark. Then mankind may have an archetypical memory, and Jungian psychology talks about this. Mankind may have a dim, distant animal memory of the time when you could be tricked and there was no escape. Now, where that manifests in popular literature, and I call it popular even though it's several hundred years old, is in the story of Faust. And in the story of Faust, Faust signs a pact with the devil and then regrets it, but he can't get out of it. Now, why am I bringing this up here? Because that's an example of where, in spiritual law, that can no longer happen. Before Lucifer, or whatever terminology you care to use for that, before Lucifer agreed to follow spiritual law, if you signed a contract, you signed a contract. It didn't have to be fair. And there may have been no redress to that. However, if spiritual law exists, and you sign a bad contract, and then you realize what you have done, spiritual law allows you to, in effect, pay back what you got from the devil, to create restitution, to take responsibility for your weakness, to pay the price for having been seduced, to accept cause and effect, that there are some things you can't fix, some things you did say done. And I could go down the list, but perhaps you get the idea. So that even though Faust was written a few hundred years ago, what it may remember or what it may bring up is a time period when spiritual laws were not in force throughout the entire universe. And just like in the Old Testament, where God says, I give you the rainbow as the sign that I will never flood the planet again. In the lectures, God says, that will not happen again. Even the dark forces must obey spiritual law. They can still get you, but they have to play by the rules. So again, I'm trying to build a context here for spiritual law. It's a huge topic. It honestly fascinates me. There's my debt. So with that introduction, I want to go into, and if you have questions at any time, please feel free to interrupt, because this can be heavy stuff. I want to go into the difference between spiritual law and human law. And the reason I want to do that is we have attitudes towards human law. And we have those attitudes from a deep place, coming up through childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, where we see human reality. And what the human mind does is it anthropomorphizes. It presumes that cats and zebras and cockatoos have the same thought process if their actions are a certain way. People think that if a bird said thank you, the bird felt gratitude, for instance. If a dog licks your hand, the dog might understand what you have done for it. We place human thinking patterns and perceptions upon lower animals. We also do that to the higher realms. We, without realizing it, well, let me back off for a second. The human mind is only so big. So let me play a little game and say that the human brain is 10 pounds. I think it's only 6, but it's a good 10 pounds. Human brain is 10 pounds. The guide says over and over again, there is so much of heaven and earth that you cannot understand with your limited human mind. He gives examples. He says there are colors in the spirit world that you simply cannot see or conceive of. Because in your human form, you have not experienced them, and with your human sensory apparatus, you cannot perceive them. In the same way, humans cannot perceive the edges of the spectrum of infrared and ultraviolet. The guide says there are sounds, which again, in human literature, the phrase is celestial spheres. And it leads me to believe that every once in a while, a few people can hear some of these sounds. And it's an amazing experience to get a taste of the spirit world. But when you come back to the earth world, you have certain tones that you can hear and certain dimensions that you can see and spectrum that you can interpret. So in the spirit world, the guide says there are more dimensions, more colors, more realities than the human mind can hold. And therefore, there is a limitation on what the guide can explain to us. Not because he doesn't want to, but because words don't do it. And even if he found the words, they would have to link into a visualization that humans cannot, generally speaking, accomplish. So in this way, when we try to understand spirit, we, without realizing it, make spirit our size. We limit spirit to what we can understand. And this is where perhaps religion and spirituality goes off the rails, because they are trying to imagine God and his commandments and his needs and wants and his communication with us, but we are in effect imagining it with a limited perception that God does not have. So in this way, spiritual law is not the equivalent of human law. And yet human law may also be a place where humans understand innately, intuitively, on a DNA cellular level, we understand law, and when we try to duplicate it, when we try to reproduce it for the purposes of our society, we don't get it right, in the sense that we have the idea, but we don't have the tools at hand. So what are the tools at hand? Human law is imperfect by definition, because you cannot know the universe, because you can never know the full depth of a human heart, because there is no rule that will cover every given situation, because there is no way to know when someone might repent or feel rehabilitated. Human law is dispensed with a very broad and crude brush. And that is what I mean by imperfect. And is that imperfection that, if we accept it, can lead us to be softer about our application of human law and human justice. But when we think the punishment fits the crime, when we think that we know what the compensatory punishment for something should be, that we can get into trouble. When we think that we're perfect, when we have a full understanding, even a full understanding, even an open and shut case in human law, does not take into account the human heart. Second aspect of spiritual law versus human law is personal. And what I mean by personal is that we strive to be fair, but we have agendas as individuals, as families, as communities, as nations, as a species. So humanity has an agenda. For instance, self-survival. Well, that may be humanity's agenda. And some science fiction comedies make fun of that when they say the aliens don't care. They really, Douglas Adams did this in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when they simply threw out leaflets to the planet Earth saying, "So terribly sorry, we have a throughway going through here. We're going to have to destroy your planet." So there's an egocentricity to the human mind and the operation of humanity that it can be lovely to be jolted out of that through humor and through storytelling, but it may also be true in a larger spiritual context. But that's not what we want as individuals. What we want as individuals is we want our laws and our justice system to serve us. To serve some great big concept in the sky does not feel satisfying and does not feel safe. So human laws were developed on a personal, on an individual self-sphere, and before I have explained the spheres, in the individual self-sphere, it is me and mine. And that's where laws started from. Human law started from trying to control the population, trying to control behavior, preserving the social fabric so that the king stayed king and the priest stayed priest and the business people stayed business people and the soldiers stayed soldiers. So for soldiers to be soldiers, there must be wars. And there's a place in development of humanity where when you want a job and you're a soldier, you need to have a war. And so your idea of justice might be, let's go to war, either because I have an army or the army is my profession and I like to exercise it. So we're not completely clean about our human law and our justice system. Human law also supports ideology. We have specific agendas in our social framework. And we strive to pass laws not necessarily because they are fair to all people, but because we believe that society would be better off if people were not allowed to camp out on the streets. People were not allowed to grow drugs for personal use. There are, you can imagine, there's a multitude of laws, not because something is specifically dangerous, immediately dangerous, but because it affects the fabric of society, and society feels it has an interest in controlling people's behavior. So there are ideologies and agendas behind human law. On the slightly more negative side, human law responds to primal needs. Now, it is a primal need to desire fairness. There is a primal need to feel closure, to feel that there was a robber, he terrorized the neighborhood, we caught the robber, and we punished the robber. We did something to either prevent him from doing it again or to teach him the error of his ways. That is primal in every society. And then, of course, it goes down into the more dark areas of retribution and revenge, where what we are trying to do is the equivalent of an eye for an eye, and also what we're trying to do is feel better. That is what retribution and revenge are about. We were hurt, we were troubled, we were upset. We want to do it to the person who did it to us. We want them to feel our pain. Now, in that specific example, perhaps you can see where that would take, please pardon the pun, that would take an act of God. Because to assure that someone who doesn't agree with your value system, which is why they did this terrible thing, feels the pain you feel because of your sensitivity and caring, it's an exercise in futility. If someone did it by accident, of course they're going to feel bad. But they already do feel bad if they share your values. So if someone is drunk and they drive on the road and they really didn't have an awareness that they were out of control and they hurt someone and they sober up the next morning, their whole life may be ruined. They may never get over it. They do feel your pain. And yet, do we let that person go off because they said, I'm sorry? That's not what we do. So as you can see, what I'm talking about here is that human law, in its imperfection, is a mishmash of control, desire for behavior, preserving social fabric, supporting ideology, responding to primal needs, acceding to the population's desire for retribution and revenge, as well as reasonable desire for closure and fairness. And then, in the end, human law, generally speaking, is steeped in duality. Human law tries to determine right versus wrong, guilty versus innocent, whether someone knew or did not know, whether they were competent or incompetent, and then whether the punishment can be defined clearly enough to make the population feel that justice was meted out. Now, on the other hand, spiritual law is perfect. And in the PC-10, there is a quote from Patrick Guide Lecture 20. And it says, God has also put into creation an infinite number of laws. I think that's interesting. Infinite number of laws. These laws provided beforehand for the possibility to return to God and when any of the created beings should misuse his power and freedom. These laws work in cycles which have to close. Whatever happens, these cycles follow their stream, and the laws work in such a way that ultimately everything that once turned from God away from divine law will come back. The greater the distance from God, the more misery. For only in God and with God lies happiness. So again, spiritual law was designed by God to have an inevitability. Spiritual law was designed as a container to support growth, to support transformation, by making it impossible for us to get away with anything. So I'm going to go back for a second to the personal, impersonal. What I mean by spiritual law being impersonal is that it is both stable and safe. No one can change spiritual law because they are upset or angry with you, or they have an opinion about you. And this would include the spirit world. So even in spirit, if one spirit had a vendetta against you, they cannot ram through the legislature a spiritual law that will affect you in any particular way. Spiritual law is universal. It applies without exception to every single being, including God and all the angels. And in this container, we can squirm and we can fidget and we can argue, but right is right, wrong is wrong. And by that, I mean not a dualistic sense, but the law of brotherhood says you need to love you and your brother. You cannot choose whom to love. Not loving one person breaks the law of brotherhood. And this, of course, is meant in a spiritual sense. You're not expected to love every person on the planet. But the importance of the law of brotherhood is that any attempt to make an exception cannot be, I keep wanting to use the word right because I'm human, but you can't do it. Trying to exclude or include at the exclusion of others breaks the law of brotherhood. So the impersonality of spiritual law makes it a stable and safe container where we cannot gain an advantage. And there is a little part in everybody's heart where we wish we knew the judge and that he smiled upon us. Because then if there was wiggle room, we could get off later. That's not how it works in spiritual law. So going back to the perfection, spiritual law is perfect because it knows the whole story. And that's where karma comes in. The guy doesn't talk a lot about karma. He talks a little bit. And basically, karma is the giant accounting system. It's just the end-all and be-all of record-keeping because you cannot get away with anything. Anything you have done must be compensated for. It doesn't have to be compensated for more than it was worth. But any transgression that you made needs to be addressed. Not paid for per se, not eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but addressed. And sometimes you can do a heinous act, and in your contrition, in your genuine and true attrition, you almost wipe the slate clean. So in spiritual law, They are looking for the entire story, and in that entire story, they know every aspect of your heart, including aspects that you may not even know about. And by know about, I mean you may not have an awareness of some of your negativity. But if it's there, and it's cranking out negativity, you are responsible. Now, why are we all responsible? Because spiritual law began before human law. And as spirits on this planet, once again, using the guide's cosmology, as spirits on this planet, we came here knowing the rules. We knew that we would not be able to remember the entire picture. Before we came, we knew our karmic balance. We might have known that carrying a heavy negative karmic balance into this life would mean that negative things would happen to us to no logical purpose or understanding, and that we might act out because of that. And that our task might be to surrender, as I spoke of before, to surrender to the possibility that there is something going on that we do not fully understand, and we're going to try to work with it and find the answers rather than protest because we don't know. But that was known before we came in as spirits. So again, the perfection is because we knew and we agreed when we came in to perform a certain task on this planet. One way of looking at that is to think of spiritual law like gravity. You may not like gravity because it doesn't let you do what you want to do. If you want to bounce like you were on the moon or on Mars and not put springs on your shoes, you might protest gravity. Or when you fall and go boom, you may protest gravity. But that's a fairly childish aspect towards gravity. What people do when they grow up is they learn to work with gravity. They learn to slingshot themselves. Athletes learn to counterbalance against gravity and get themselves going to a point where gravity pulls them or pushes them. We bend the law of gravity by working with it. We find its parameters. We accept it and come up with countermeasures so that we can still be free to do some things. Rather than suspending or breaking it. So imagine a world where if every time somebody wanted to leap tall buildings with a single bound, they flipped the switch that controls gravity, and the rest of us who were not quite prepared for that, all of a sudden, there's no gravity, and if you were running upstairs, you're now hitting the ceiling. That's why spiritual law cannot have exceptions for specific people. It must be uniform, but that does not mean you cannot work within it. So again, I said that if you commit an act and you come back into spiritual law and in effect say, I'm guilty, I'm wrong, I want to understand it, I want to perform restitution for it, and I want to come into spiritual law and do what I have to do to make up for it. That the going out may be a terrible act, but the coming back in may have far more ease than we imagine, because again, in spiritual law, perhaps we broke the law to learn that it was a law, to learn the negative aspects of cheating. And once we have, and we come back and say, I understand, I won't do it again, what chore would you like me to do to prove that I understand and to make up for what I did and to give back what I got? This is how spiritual law works. So it's perfect, it's impersonal. Its purpose is to create an inevitability of the possibility of returning to God, but it also allows for our free will. The container of spiritual law says you can do whatever you please. And you'll need to learn from it because you'll go more and more and more negative, possibly into death and possibly into many negative lifetimes, because you can't change spiritual law. Creating negativity will bring negativity back into your life. But if you believe that you can get away with it, you go right ahead. You take your best shot. It won't change spiritual law, and therefore we will put you in a situation and let you act out and hold that container for you, so that when you say, this isn't working, this creates pain not only to my fellow man, but now it's creating pain to me, that by following spiritual law, you can become enfolded and find your way back to God. The Patrick lectures presume that there is a finite quality to negativity. It's a dead end. It's no fun, and it's boring. So without saying you must come back to God, there is a presumption that where else would you go? To find pleasure, to find bliss, to feel connected to others. How else can you do that except through positive intention and positive action? So it's kind of a setup that the inevitable result must be that we come back to God. And we may go out again and come back and out again. So it's not that there's an end game or an end to what we do, but an inevitability to it. And the last part about spiritual law is that even though human law is individual self-fear, and at its best, the best laws that we've got are still universal self-fear. Because human beings do not make laws about spirit. We don't know enough. We don't do it because we have no way of getting feedback. In arrogance, we can do it. You can say that you are going to pass such a law. But you can't. If you can't get feedback about it, if you can't detect whether it was broken or whether it was followed, it is a de facto statement rather than any viable law. So human law is on the individual self-sphere of me and mine, on the universal self-sphere of us. Us meaning humanity. Whereas spiritual law is based upon the unitive. All spirit, all creation, all energy, and all consciousness. So what I wanted to do was differentiate the two, because human law engenders a sense of rebelliousness sometimes. Human law can engender a sense of resentment of authority, so that we are uncomfortable with the idea of law because we have seen it badly enacted. And again, the point is that, yes, it was badly enacted. But the reason it was badly enacted was because it was based on the imperfection of being human. So are there any questions?
Jan, would you mind addressing what you just said with regard to expressions of religion like the Bible and other literature with regard to the human and spiritual aspect of religious expression?
Okay. I'm going to put out a caveat first. I believe in staying true to what you know, and I feel that it's appropriate for me to teach pathwork. It is not appropriate for me to teach any other religion. I'm simply not trained well enough. So I work with off-the-cuff examples. I work with what I consider to be common stories. And these I have read about and I have some knowledge of, but I do not presume to teach about or make specific references to dogma. I just want to say that out of respect. So if I get it wrong, What I'm trying to do is offer you examples. And I may not get it, I may not do a good enough job with my analogies. Okay?
Okay.
So one example of spiritual law and human law that I actually found some articles on and did some teaching on during a workshop once was the story in the New Testament of the prodigal son, where he comes back and he in effect says, I'm sorry, I learned my lesson. And the father says, come in, come in, and kills the fatted calf. And the son who stayed behind is resentful because he stayed behind and he worked. And his brother went off and had a good time. And this would be an example of where the, I don't know if it's the elder or the younger son, I honestly can't remember, but the son who stayed home is making a case for, I did this much work and he didn't, and therefore our rewards should be proportional to that value. The younger son, I think it was the younger, who came back, when he came back to the father, said, make me a slave. I don't ask to be your son. I went off and spent my inheritance. It's my fault. I understand. I simply want to be home, and I'll take whatever I have to take to be allowed to come home. So from his value system, he was perfectly willing to live with inequity for the rest of his life to pay for what he learned. From the father's point of view, he simply loves both his sons, and he's not interested in a continuation of punishment. Perfectly happy to let it go and take back in. I think that the son who stayed home represents the point of view of a lot of human justice, where we are leery of being taken advantage of, where we are concerned that the point did not get made and it will happen again. Another example, which may be a little tender, maybe a bit sensitive, is more social than religious. And that is that there's a lot of stuff in the news about sexual predators and how they are being put on databases and they are being tracked so that someone serves their sentence and gets out of prison. I'm presuming they got out legitimately because they're on parole. And yet they can't be left in peace. They are hunted by the vigilante groups. They have protesters in front of their homes. They can't get, they can't rent apartments, they can't find jobs. That this is a continuation of sentencing by the public beyond what the law requested. And that is done because people feel the law was not strong enough. Now, your question was about religion, okay, and that's harder. Because, again, people feel very strongly about their religious beliefs. But if a religious group feels, for instance, that valuing males and females differently is a spiritual value, they believe quite honestly that this is what their intuitive process of interpreting spiritual messages has told them, and another group feels the opposite. This is where human interpretations of spiritual experiences, spiritual epiphanies and ahas, may have what the guide describes is these contain a grain of truth. It's not that people are crazy. When hundreds of thousands of people believe something, there's a grain of truth in there. There is also agenda. There is also the culture that they came from when they got the aha. There is also protest and power. There's a lot going on in human society besides a spiritual epiphany. So what humans do is they will take a grain of truth, and I'm more familiar with the Protestant, Catholic, Western European history. But in that history, popes were not neutral. They got on different sides, on different wars for different reasons, because their sister married a king. A pope will excommunicate another king. This has nothing to do with spiritual law. And yet, if spiritual doctrine says the Pope is never wrong, we have a conflict here. So the spiritual doctrine may have developed because surrender to authority is a process that instills a certain humility. Not perfect, but does a pretty good job. But in that process of getting the population to surrender to you, if the person they're surrendering to is not clean about that and takes advantage, then they have distorted that spiritual process. Does that come close to answering your question, Harry?
Well, that's a good part of it. The idea of so much emphasis is played on the literal aspect of religious documents, you know, and it seems like that might be more human than the spiritual sometimes.
That's how the guide describes it. Basically, and that's why when I started off in the beginning, I find it of tremendous help to me when I feel this crunch between the spiritual and the human, and it just doesn't seem to make sense. When the guide says humans get a whiff, they get a sense of the spirit, but not a clear enough picture. So they have to fill in the blanks. And they fill it in from their limited understanding. If you are filled with the Holy Spirit, if you really believe that you have visited the spirit world and been in the presence of God, you may wish to give this experience to others. In the giving, we have to be specific. What are you going to give them? So, for instance, in Sufi, they believe that if you trance dance, if you spin, you will see God. Now, you can mock them. You can say, yes, you get dizzy, you fall down and disoriented, you have a hallucination, you think you see God. There may be a grain of truth there. It may also be that in the disorientation, you lose your grip on the human experience and you create room for the divine to come in. Now, if two people stand in front of you and they both claim a similar experience, you may not be able to tell who is speaking a more divine truth. And so we use our human experience to decide who's telling the truth and who isn't. And that is how we choose our spiritual leaders in the beginning. However, over time, this choosing of spiritual leaders creates the equivalent of a dynasty. Just like kings and queens, when you have a power structure, power chooses power. And the only way you change that is to have a revolution. So when we self-select, we may not be as open, as clean. You know, when people have power, they're not eager to give it away. So this is where, in the human experience, we may have begun from a place of clairvoyance, clairaudience, deep spiritual contact. But over millennia, we have built social structures that are not as fluid as the original experience was. And we become unwilling to give up our doctrines. So, for instance, if a tablet was discovered in one of the old sites, Egypt, Middle East, whatever, that refuted one of the major religions, they'd have trouble with that. Number one, they'd question, is this true? But even if it was true, a lot of people aren't necessarily willing to change their social structure and their doctrine at the drop of a hat. It might take a great deal more than a single tablet for someone to say, oh, we'll just take this tenet out of our religion and throw it away. So I feel it's very, very important to honor the human experience of religion and yet slightly differentiate that from the spiritual experience that may have inspired it. They are not the same. So just as I described human law and spiritual law, there's religion and spiritual experience. And they may not happen concurrently, consistently. That's all?